Hello and welcome to Carefully Considered, the podcast about caring, the issues unpaid carers face and how we solve them. I'm Katie, an unpaid carer and the founder of the We Care campaign, a grassroots organisation empowering carers to feel visible and valued.
And I'm Laura, also an unpaid carer, and we're here to inform and hopefully entertain you. Each episode we'll be talking to an expert to get their views to see what we can all do to get the change millions of carers across the UK need. Right, Katie, let's get cracking. How are you?
Right, well, we're getting ready to deliver a care package, I really like that term, to carers as a free online course in Wales. So I'm really, really excited about that because that's the first time we've ever done anything like that. And we're also looking at our fundraising and grants and things like that. It's a busy time.
It is.
But this episode is going to be really special, isn't it, Laura?
Yes, it is. We are not speaking to a carer. We're speaking to Rory Kellen-Jones, OBE and former BBC News technology correspondent and acclaimed author. He was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in 2019 and has been very open about living with his progressive illness, and we're delighted to have him on. Welcome to the podcast, Rory. Thank you for being with us today.
Very excited to be on this. Honoured, in fact.
That's really, really sweet. For those who don't know your work, Rory, could you introduce yourself for us? And how would you introduce yourself to a stranger if you sat next to them at a dinner party?
Well, I think I might say for many years I was the bloke telling you about technology on BBC television and radio and online. Since I left the BBC just over 3 years ago, I've done a lot of podcasting and writing about health and technology, but above all else, completely outshining everything else, I am known as the owner of Sophie, a rescue dog from Romania. If I get stopped in the street and somebody comes up to me, I can guess instantly what they're going to say. And it's going to be, "How's Sophie?" Not, "Tell me about the latest gadget or what's going on in the health tech world."
So you're the wingman for a dog?
I'm the wingman for a dog, yeah, yeah. I was being filmed for breakfast television and walking here the other day, and I said, someone stopped me on my walk and said, "She's more famous than you, mate." And I said, he got that absolutely right.
Well, before you were Sophie's wingman, could you just quickly talk us through your illustrious career as a BBC journalist?
Well, I was with the BBC for 40 years. Not long after leaving university, I got a short-term contract as a researcher in Leeds and went on to become a reporter, first on business and then for many years on technology. And it was my job to take complex subjects and try and reach a big audience with them. And among the stories I covered, I was there when the original iPhone was launched, which kind of marked the beginning of the smartphone years, which has been incredibly important. I've interviewed many of the big figures in computing, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, the dreaded Elon Musk, before he went completely bonkers. And I've done a lot about issues like quantum computing, which are pretty difficult to understand. But since leaving the BBC, I found a whole new career. I've been unexpectedly busy podcasting with a group of fellow Parkinson's people, Parkies, we call ourselves sometimes, in a hit podcast called Movers and Shakers. And I've got a Substack, which is sort of kind of like a newsletter, where I write about health and technology. And I've written two books, one a memoir about my extraordinary mother and the thousands of letters she left behind, which told the scandalous story of my birth, Ruskin Park, quick plug for that. And then, inevitably, a book about Sophie from Romania, which has occupied a lot of my time. So I've been busy.
Yeah, you could say that, couldn't you? Rory, could you tell us about what led you to getting yourself checked out initially? Because I know from my husband has a progressive degenerative disease and he started to fall over. So that was our clue. So what was your clue?
We were on holiday in the summer of 2018 in Italy. And when we were out walking, my wife kept saying, "You're dragging your foot. Pick your feet up, man, in a slightly brisk way. And I realised I was dragging my right foot. And I used to run a bit and have running injuries and have a lovely physio, an Australian guy called Greg. And I took this to him, and he was either puzzled or he actually knew, I think deep down, this what might be wrong. And he said, "You really need to go to your GP with that." And then I saw my GP, and then I got referred 4 months later, which turns out to be standard and, in fact, quite speedy, to a consultant, and got diagnosed with Parkinson's. But it was not a surprise when the diagnosis came because, you know, well, for one thing, somebody had written into the BBC, having seen me holding a cable in a live broadcast and my hand shaking, and said he should really get that checked out because that can be a sign of Parkinson's disease. So I wasn't at all surprised when the diagnosis came.
You say you weren't surprised when the diagnosis came. Sort of, I guess maybe then when the idea started being that it might be Parkinson's disease, what went through your head? How did you sort of react to that quite heavy diagnosis?
It is a very heavy diagnosis, but it wasn't a huge blow. I knew about Parkinson's because my dad had it when he was pretty old. So, you know, it was kind of one more thing, and he had died. Well, he was actually still alive when I got the diagnosis. He died later that year. But what lessened the impact in a way was that I'd had a very serious illness 20 years earlier, almost. Well, back in 2004-5, I was diagnosed with a malignant melanoma behind my left eye, a cancer, which was very frightening and felt life-threatening. And I'd gone on to have treatment for that and be monitored regularly, and still am to this day, by Moorfields Hospital. And, you know, my fear of that lessened, but Parkinson's, by comparison, seemed okay, whatever, just another thing, but not the kind of really scary thing that the word cancer has.
That's really interesting that, you know, you had that. I do remember you being very open about that as well, actually. As somebody that goes to Moorfields myself, you know, I know how amazing that place is. So when did you start to think about the fact that you might have a potential need for care? Was there a gradual realisation, or was there like a catalyst that you thought, I might need some help here?
Well, I'm not sure that's even arrived yet. I mean, I'm 6 years in. Today as we're recording, I think it's actually the anniversary. May well be the sixth anniversary. Because it was in early January that I went to St Mary's Hospital Paddington and was told in a slightly clumsy way by, not the consultant, but an assistant, that I had signs of Parkinsonism. And I knew it was a disease, a progressive disease. Progressive all sounds great, isn't it? Oh, it's really progressive, this disease. Not so much. But I didn't immediately sort of start clocking about care. The dreadful truth, I suppose, is that I've been married a long time. I'm married to a wonderful woman. And I suspect, subconsciously thought, you know, she'll look after me. But I didn't, you know, sit down and think about it in any way. I tell you what did bring it home was a year or so ago, I had a really bad fall, which wasn't really to do with Parkinson's. I was hurrying on a dark night. I was going off to babysit my grandkids, and I fell over a branch that had blown down onto the pavement. And I fractured my elbow and was in a pretty bad way, and had a very bad NHS experience where they sent me home with an open fracture, and there was, in fact, they had an inquiry about it afterwards. But that during that period, I became very reliant on Diane to, you know, frankly, help me get dressed, take a shower and so on. And that really, you know, set me thinking about the future, I suppose, and becoming more dependent on other people and in particular on my wife.
Had you, speaking of that, because your wife is quite an illustrious professor and she's, you know, she has a sort of big career of her own, etc. Have you had a talk with her about the potential need for her to care for you more, or even her becoming an unpaid carer? Have you both looked into what that might mean, or are you going to sort of, I guess, tackle it as it arises, I guess? Because it's a very uncomfortable thing, isn't it? Because it's also an unknown. I wonder if you've thought about that at all.
Do you know, we haven't. We're kind of, Diane in particular is a very practical, get on with things. And she's an incredibly busy and organised person. She spends half the week in Cambridge where she's a professor. And then when she is home, as she is right now, she's working very hard in her office. So far, she's not had to be much of a carer in the sort of the full-on sense. And we haven't really talked about it. The only time we talked about it, actually, was when we did an episode of our Movers and Shakers podcast about our partners, and I interviewed her for that. And we realised afterwards that it was the first time, and I interviewed one of our kids as well, that we talked as a family about it. It was just kind of, well, let's get on with life. And she, of course, had gone through all the strain of when I was diagnosed with the eye cancer, and that had been an awful burden on her. So she'd come through that. So she's a strong person. And she'll say herself, she's quite northern in her attitudes, you know. Put yourself together, lad.
Oh, that's good to know. I find that, like, I can cope with the big things. It's when something little goes, like the boiler, or you break the key in the door or something like that, and then your whole world seems to fall apart. So, yeah, I can sort of understand that.
What is happening is that I am getting slower. I mean, every morning we get up and we take the dog out together if we're both here. And she's quite often waiting downstairs while I'm struggling to put on a jumper. And she's having to get used to the fact that I've always been a slightly chaotic person and she's been the organised person. When I bake, she claims that I put flour all over the kitchen on every single surface and why is this necessary? Whereas I claim she's a bit OCD about it, but, you know, it works.
Did you come across the term unpaid carer before, Rory, at all?
Yeah, I'm sort of aware of it and I've heard, you know, some extraordinary cases and some admirable cases, but I hadn't really thought it through and, you know, I'm very interested in the amazing work you guys are doing.
It's funny, isn't it, that... And I think this is part of the crux of the issue of, because it's not a very known thing or people sort of don't really think that they to overuse the word identify as an unpaid carer or see themselves as that, then when there is a need for more care or when there is a need for more formalized care, it often doesn't happen or is late or is inadequate because people don't think about it. And I think that's an interesting...
People take it for granted, yeah.
Yeah, people take it
I've
for granted.
I've got a case in
yeah.
my family, a very elderly relative. He's being looked after by her son who's flown home from... He lived in Kenya for many years and he's come home and he's now a full-time carer and is a wonderful person. So that's been brought it to mind, really. Because he's having to make all those decisions about how long he can do this without... She would definitely be in residential care by now if he hadn't been as determined as he is to keep her at home.
Do you think about the cost of care as well? So, you know, I care for my elderly grandmother, and so there is questions about residential care, etc., and how expensive that is, or even paid care to come in and help privately because the social care system is inadequate at best. Do you think about the cost of private care at all? Has that been a conversation about starting saving or starting to sort of cost it out should you need it?
We haven't talked about it for me, but I'm very aware of it because, as I say, that this elderly relative, and also my father in his last years, he had a fall about four or five years before he died and broke his leg. And with Parkinson's, and at that age, a broken leg basically meant he lost his mobility. And he had virtually full time carers. Actually, he did have full time carers for the last 2 or 3 years of his life, so I was aware of that. And that was organised by my sister, my half-sister, who herself is an extraordinary person and was, you know, in charge of his care.
You've been very open about your diagnosis, Rory. And can you tell us what was behind that decision to be as open about it as you have been? Because I'm sure it's helped many, many people.
Well, it was interesting. I'm a bit of a social media addict. I mean, it was part of my job at the BBC. I was a very early adopter of first Facebook, then Twitter, and became perhaps overly obsessed with Twitter. My wife accuses me of wasting hours surfing Twitter. That was quite attractive because as a BBC reporter, you were, certainly in my early years, you were not really encouraged to have a personality. And suddenly, with social media, and there were all sorts of pitfalls in this too, you were able to have a personality. And it brought you an engagement with the audience, which was completely different from when I started. I used to be on the news a lot. I mean, I was in 2003 when there was a fire brigade strike. There was one week when I was on every single news bulletin, 1, 6 and 10, for a week. But that did not bring me the sort of engagement or recognition from the audience that having 200,000 followers on Twitter, which is what I had when I was diagnosed. And what happened was one day, about 4 or 5 months into my diagnosis, when some friends at work knew, my bosses knew, but wider public didn't, my producer said to me, have you ever thought about going public? We were out filming something. It was the launch of 5G in the UK. And I'd done a piece on breakfast television and we were going off to do more filming. And I said, no, well, I had thought about it, but why are you bringing it up now? And she said, well, your tremor was very evident on the television. So I said, okay, I'll do something. And I just went to Twitter, which was my normal sort of channel, and knocked out this little tweet saying, some people noticed my hand shaking. I've been diagnosed recently with Parkinson's, but I'm getting good treatment, onwards and upwards, something to that effect. Put it out. We were on a train going to Birmingham, and put it out at Birmingham International. And by the time I got out at Birmingham News Street, my phone was already alive with people reacting. I got phone calls from newspapers and all that. And the reaction was great. It was hugely warm and supportive. I mean, there was one guy who said, you've been standing too near to too many 5G phone masts. But, you know,
there's always one,
isn't there? Apart from that, it was pretty encouraging. And ever since then, I found it's good to talk. And people, because I talked about it, that's how this podcast came about, because another colleague who I didn't really know, Edward Sturton, a very distinguished broadcaster, rang me up one day and said, my oldest friend has just been diagnosed with Parkinson's and is in a bad way, could you have a chat to him? And this friend turned out to be a judge.
I love him. He's great.
Yes. He was Britain's top divorce lawyer, advised Paul McCartney on his divorce, and he's quite a character. So when I met him, he didn't seem in a bad way at all, because he was just so enthusiastic. And we ended up gathering a bunch of people, including Jeremy Paxman and Mark Bardell, another BBC colleague, and Gillian Lacey-Solomar and Paul Mayhew Archer, in this pub. And the judge kept going on. Well, first he said we ought to write a book, and Jeremy Paxman said that was the worst idea anybody had had ever. And then he started on a podcast, and I could sort of see that it might work, but I was still dubious. But it did work, and it's been an extraordinary way of sharing our lives with Parkinson's and creating a community around it, actually.
Yeah, it's called Movers and Shakers, and it's very jovial in tone, which I appreciate as somebody who works in media, etc. I find that the coverage of illness or care is very gloomy, and I understand why producers do it, because they sort of want that sort of dark and gloomy human interest story, for like 3 minute piece on the news, and everybody so sad and depressed, and it is hard. But I feel that I think people might gravitate more to more conversational, relatable and jovial conversations. Was that intentional in how you run your podcast?
I always said, and I say in most intros when I'm presenting it, we come here for a laugh and a moan. So we're in the pub, and just as when we meet not having a podcast,
yeah.
You don't immediately sit down going, oh, life's terrible. You do have a moan about you froze when I was trying to get off the tube or this, that and the other. But you also have a laugh. And that's the spirit we bring to the podcast. And I think people do appreciate it. If anybody wants a real laugh, but also possibly a little weep, they either sadness or amazement, they ought to go and see our video, We Will Survive, where Gillian Lacey-Solomar of our number has rewritten the lyrics to Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive. And we've done a professionally shot pop video about living with Parkinson's. Find it on YouTube. Search for Movers and Shakers, We Will Survive.
We'll put that in the show notes,
yeah,
won't we?
See, Katie, this is why we need Rory's consulting on how to up the unpaid caring visibility.
Again.
Yeah, this is fab. We could do some of that.
Brilliant. So have you been investigating any tech that can help Parkinson's patients, Rory? I mean, we've got to ask you that because you're the perfect person to look at that.
Well, it's funny to say that. I have a lot. In fact, I've got these extraordinary shoes at the moment. That I said to Diane the other night, this is the most extraordinary first living line, but I'm worried that my shoes aren't recharging. Somebody's brought out a pair of shoes with a sort of a unit in each sole, which is, I describe as a sort of mini iPhone, which both records the way you're walking, because actually for me and for lots of people, gait is a really big issue, and supposedly can correct it slightly by buzzing, setting up a sort of rhythm in your shoe. It's a Swiss company that has managed to sell these shoes to doctors as a way of measuring how the disease is progressing, because we're all used to going to the doctor once a year, the hospital doctor once a year, and them saying, walk up and down outside my office, and then grabbing you by the shoulders to see if you fall back or whatever, a whole series of tests. And these shoes are supposed to give a more kind of objective measurement that you can compare between appointments. Anyway, so I'm testing those. And I also met yesterday a man who I've met before who's got a pen that can diagnose Parkinson. We were both on the Royal Institution Christmas lectures where he demonstrated this with me as the guinea pig. And it's about early diagnosis, which we've had some discussions about on the podcast, whether it would be good or bad to know early that you had Parkinson's. But I think the growing consensus amongst researchers and doctors is that if we're to understand and therefore beat these conditions, early diagnosis is important, because then you can really work at, you know, drugs that might actually slow its progress.
I have to ask about AI. How do you think AI will factor in these types of technology on the diagnostic side or on the sort of caring, you know, once you've had the diagnosis side?
Well, I mean, AI is every, you know, I don't ever get a press release these days that doesn't include the expression AI in it. You know, the local fish shop is using AI to serve you fish and chips. And certainly in the health world, I mean, there is a lot of excitement about it, and I've written a lot about it, and I think it's still quite a mystery as to what will be the useful and cost-effective ways of deploying it. There's lots of wild ideas. I think many of them will not come to much. But here's one example. They're often quite mundane examples. You know, helping better organisation of the way health services are delivered. We all know that when you go and see your GP or another doctor, quite often these days, they spend all the time looking at a computer screen, not at you. And now this technology has been developed, which records the conversation. So you walk in, the doctor presses a button, and this program records what's said. And at the end, it produces one of those letters. You know, we've all had those letters. This charming gentleman, this delightful lady presented with blah, blah, blah. Another sort of bugbear of mine.
Did they ever say this objectionable person?
Yes, this objectionable woman.
What do you have to do to get that?
Yeah, actually, by the by, one doctor told me that if he didn't say this charming gentleman, this gentleman was code for this absolute whatever. Anyway, this AI actually performs better than the doctor in writing those letters and saves them time. I mean, they obviously have to check them at the end, but also enables them to spend more time looking at you and, you know, engaging with you than when they're tapping away at a computer. So those kind of uses, I think, are quite impressive.
It's amazing because, yeah, there's nothing more annoying than the doctor not looking up.
Yes.
I have to say. And especially when you're there for your annual appointment or whatever.
Yeah, I always worry that I can't remember what's been said. So it'd be great from a patient's point of view to have that recording. And yeah, actually, on my Substack about health tech, joking apart, there's a group of, I took part in a webinar with doctors who have led a campaign that those letters should actually be addressed to the patient, copied to the GP rather than vice versa. And yes, there are difficulties with language, but these doctors insist that you can manage it so that both audiences get served. And it's very important in terms of communicating with the patients that they get the letter.
Absolutely. Well, the AI notes and things, that sounds absolutely fantastic. Now, Rory, we could not have you on without talking about the bond you have with a very special rescue dog. And now I'm going to make you all cringe. Bony Fido celebrity.
Very good.
I know. It just came to me, seriously. So Sophie from Romania. Could you tell us a bit about how you came to rescue her and what she brings to your life?
Rory? Well, we had a lovely dog called Cabbage, who was herself a rescue dog, a Collie Cross that we got from the Dogs Trust many years ago. And she eventually died, and we were very, very cut up about it, and Diane in particular didn't want to get a new dog in a hurry. But when we came to look for a new dog, just before Christmas 2022, we found that it was quite difficult. The dogs in rescue homes, a lot of them seem to be staffies, and there were also lots of restrictions. Oh, this dog is no good with children. This dog is doesn't like men. And it all just seemed really tricky, and we were sort of pondering what to do when a friend recommended a Romanian rescue dog site. She had a dog which seemed quite sweet, and we ended up getting Sophie, who actually was named Seven at first, and I said, I'm not running around shouting Seven like some crazed Strictly Come Dancing judge. And she arrived just before Christmas on this transport, which had taken 3 days with about two dozen other dogs, and arrived in the middle of the night, and she was absolutely terrified. And we weren't surprised at first, because, you know, old dog had been quite scared when we first got her, but it settled down quickly. This dog did not settle down. Well, she did settle down behind our red sofa and barely came out. She eventually, after a month, would go into the garden, which was a relief in terms of house training, because she was house trained from then on. But it took more than 6 months for her to not spend most of her time behind the sofa, ignoring the shiny new bed we bought for her and so on. And because I, as I said earlier, I'm addicted to social media, I talked about this on Twitter, and it just went viral like that. It was something to do, I think, with the time, quite a dark time. The Ukraine war had started, cost of living crisis, and people latched onto it as a hopeful story, because in the early days, it seemed like she might make progress quite rapidly, but she didn't. And she became this huge thing in our lives. And she still is. I mean, she's a lot better 2.5 years on. She comes up, she's upstairs at the moment, just around the corner in my wife's office. And that only happened in recent months. She would not go upstairs. And now she sleeps in our bedroom. But she is still incredibly fearful of lots of things. And for instance, people coming to the house will get barked at furiously. She sees them as a big threat. So she's a work in progress.
What does she bring to your life? Is there, I know that on your podcast, you did an episode about, you know, pets and sort of how they can help with Parkinson's. Is there a link there as well in terms of what she brings to you?
Well, I think there definitely is. I mean, we're both sort of kind of slightly damaged beings. I mean, she's damaged by fear. I'm damaged by Parkinson's. And she gives me something else to focus on. You know, she is pretty all-consuming because, you know, for instance, I haven't travelled much for the last year because somebody's got to be at home. We can't really... We used to leave our old dog with a friend, but we couldn't possibly do that with Sophie. So she's something... You know, something else to worry about. And she's also incredibly rewarding when she does, you know, respond. And when she gives me the paw, you know, it's just really sweet. And if I've got cheese on my plate, she'll be there.
Yeah, they've figured that out. She'll figure the bed out. Yeah. Does she sleep on the bed or not yet?
Diane usually goes to bed before me. I'm not a very good sleeper. But I do quite often creep in and find the dog in my place on the bed.
Yeah.
I get in and she sort of grumbles a bit and then jumps off the bed. Yeah, yes.
You've written a book about her arrival called Sophie from Romania. What was that like? Because as I follow you on social media, so I used to see, you know, she's still behind the couch. What are we going to do? And I know that you got a dog trainer in. So when you got the request, I guess, to, to write the book. Did you think, when am I going to write? She's still behind the couch? Or sort of how did that, what was that like? What was writing the book like?
Well, it was extraordinary because I was just finishing off my previous book, Ruskin Park, about my mum and the story of my birth. When my agent called me, and this was only about a month after we got Sophie, saying she'd got five major publishers asking if I was going to write a book. So there was a competition and I had to write the book. And actually my first worry was there going to be enough to say? Because it was supposed to be a year with the dog. And I thought, well, we've got these initial problems. It'll soon sort itself out and then she'll just be a normal dog. But of course that didn't happen. So there was plenty to write about. And then my worry became, we need a happy ending.
Yes.
And I'd been building up towards a walk and it just wasn't happening. I had my fall toward the end of the year, which really set us back a long way. So we got to the end of the year and I tried to give it a sort of uplifting end. But luckily the publisher allowed me a sort of epilogue. And 2 months after the end of the year, we got her out for a first walk, which was a huge moment. So that was great. But it was an intense experience because what I was sharing was what I was not sharing on social media. Far more of the downs as well as the ups. Because it was actually a real worry to me. It gave me sleepless nights, the state of the dog and what we're going to do about her. And I've shared a lot about that and a lot about Parkinson's in the book too as well. It's our two journeys, really, the dog and mine.
And also there's a parallel with caring as well, I think. Don't you think, Katie, about sort of the worry, the focusing on sort of it gives you something else to worry about, the fact that you guys can't really leave the house. There's sort of a little bit of, in the restrictions of care, when you are an unpaid carer, there's similar things to think about because you are obviously, you know, caring for something else, for somebody else or another creature. And I think that was, from the beginning of the book, it does give me there's a few parallels with being a carer as well. It was interesting.
I thought that secretly, but I would never have dared say that to you guys, for whom I've got extraordinary respect. But yeah, it obviously doesn't compare with what you do, but there's some of the same strains.
Yes.
It puts on you.
Oh, that's well done, Laura, for drawing that out.
Hey, I'm a PR. I will find the angle. I will find the link. Don't you worry.
Finally, do you have any advice for people recently diagnosed with Parkinson's disease or any other progressive disease or their carers? Have you got any helpful strategies to cope? Or
well, yeah. I mean, we've got a campaign on our slightly anarchic podcast called the Parky Charter, calling for a number of things, including, well, massively important, more neurologists to get people to that first diagnosis and cut the period of uncertainty, but also to give people plenty of information when they're first diagnosed. Because consultants are usually very good at talking about drugs, but there's all sorts of other aspects that are important with Parkinson's, notably exercise and diet, and they very, very rarely tell you about all those things. So I would say, well, of course, my first advice would be tune into Movers and Shakers, which is more than 50 episodes now on just about every aspect, and they're stacked up there. You should go back to the beginning, really, and pick and choose. But also, and I say this as someone who's reluctant to do this at first, it's worth joining a group. There are lots of local groups, and it's incredibly supportive to be able to talk to other people facing what you're talking to them about. I mean, people have said to us, thank goodness someone's talking about this, because we felt so alone. Someone in my area has just started a group. I'd never fancied going to a group because, frankly, one has these prejudices that, oh, it'll be all old people. And then I realise I'm an old person too. But, and in a way, we've got a group, our Movers and Shakers pub group. Talking helps, I'd say. Shared experience really helps.
Yeah, I'd reiterate that about community, isn't it? It's finding somebody that you can talk to that really understands, which is what we've sort of created here. But also, I help support the local group for the Motor Neuron Disease Association, is the disease that my husband has. And it's amazing. It's very, very difficult. persuade somebody to come through those doors, but once they do, and then they realise that, you know, we're having a laugh, we're having a cup of tea, and we're talking about it, then that's really, really valuable. And yeah, so it is definitely worth joining a group if you can, and steel yourself to walking through those doors for the first time.
And listen to the pod. I don't have Parkinson's, and I don't care if somebody has Parkinson's, but I love it. It's great. I just find it's interesting. The conversation's great, and you do learn a lot as well. So I think it's a good pod to have on your rota and people's listening rotas.
Thank you.
It's great. Well, we could talk to you for hours, but I'm sure that you're very busy and we're running out of time. So thank you so much, Rory, honestly, for coming on and speaking with us today. Where can our listeners go to find more information about you, and where can they get your most recent book, Sophie from Romania?
Well, Sophie from Romania is available from all good booksellers online and on the high street. And if your bookseller doesn't have it, tell them they need to have it. But it's actually been on sale for the last few days at a good price, so get out there now. My Substack is, if you just search for, it's called Always On, which was the name of a book I wrote about technology. That if you subscribe to that, and you can subscribe for free. Some people pay to support the work, but you can get it all for free. That keeps you up to date both with what's happening on the podcast and my more general interest in health and technology and AI and the health service and so on. I'm increasingly, although I love Twitter, I'm increasingly sort of alienated from it. So I'm spending more time on Instagram, where I'm Rory Kethlin, and on Blue Sky, where I'm something quite complicated, which I can't remember, but I'm on Blue Sky. You'll find me easily enough if you join that.
That's great. Well, thank you so much, Rory, for coming on and for speaking with us today. And thank you so much to everyone for listening. Please follow, rate and subscribe to wherever you get your podcasts.
We'd love to hear from you, whether it is questions, guest suggestions or anything else. Please email us at wearecarers, which is all one word, @gmail.com. Until next time.
Until next time.
Thank you very much. It's been a blast.